Today on the podcast, John Quinn, the founder of Quinn Emanuel, talks about his life, his work, and working from home.
I personally think there's no turning back to a situation where everybody's expected to be in the office.
Hello, you're listening to On the Merits, the weekly legal news podcast from Bloomberg Law. I'm your host, David Schultz. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably know who John Quinn is. But if you don't, he may not be what you think about when you think about a big law titan who founded one of the top 100 firms in the country. Forget a three-piece suit and a mahogany desk. When Quinn spoke to us, he was in a super comfortable cotton hoodie in an office with walls covered floor to ceiling with contemporary art. Art is one of his many passions. He opened an art museum in his home of Los Angeles 6 years ago. He also climbs mountains, runs triathlons, owns a Michelin-starred sushi restaurant, and has his own podcast called Law Disrupted. Oh, and by the way, Quinn is also a name partner at Quinn Emanuel, arguably the largest litigation and arbitration firm in the world. Another way that Quinn goes against the grain is that he doesn't seem to frown on the idea of remote work. Far from it. Bloomberg Law's Roy Strom had a wide-ranging and candid conversation with Quinn about where his firm and the broader legal industry is heading, and Quinn explained how he and his firm learned to love working from home.
There are an awful lot of people who enjoy working from wherever they want to work, and we learned, you know, by the way, before March of 2020, I never would have anticipated this, but we learned that we can do our work, represent our clients, do hearings, take and defend depositions and pretty much everything else except jury trials remotely. So the first thing was we knew it could be done, and it could be done efficiently. It's not necessarily for people to pile into airplanes and fly across the country or even get into a taxi and go to court to get our work done. So it was more efficient, easier for us, more efficient for clients. And there are a lot of reasons why people like doing it. The other thing was, we saw it during the pandemic, like many firms, we've had a real challenge recruiting the number of associates that we need to do the work that's on our plate. And it occurred to us that, you know, there might be outstanding lawyers in cities where we don't have offices, you know, maybe Boise, Des Moines, Charleston, you know, take your pick, but there might be outstanding lawyers who happen to be there for whatever reason. And if we adopted this policy, maybe we'd be able to recruit some people we otherwise wouldn't get if our policy was you have to, you know, live in a city where we have a physical office.
I guess, do you have any concerns at all about lawyers getting the right kind of mentoring or just sort of development working this way? Firms have had such an office-first culture for so long. Do you have to change anything to account for the fact that people are living all over, not in the office with each other every day?
Absolutely. We're very concerned about that. We're very concerned about that because the way we all learned what it meant to be a lawyer and how to do our jobs was by being in the office, and in my case, sharing an office with an older lawyer when I first started and hearing how they talk and how they, you know, conducted themselves and the water cooler conversations and walking into the office of the lawyer next door, you know, even apart from the more formal you know, tutorial and professional education programs that law firms would put on. So from the very beginning, we identified that as something we had to address. How do we come up with something like that, the online equivalent of that, or make those types of experiences available to people? And that's something that we've given a lot of thought and effort to.
Any examples of new stuff that you'll do?
Well, for example, we've instituted something that we call the Quinn Emanuel Academy. And we have something like 60 offerings where lawyers in the firm will talk about different subjects. It might be one session all online, might be one session, it might be multiple sessions where they talk about things like how to conduct an internal investigation or, you know, marketing, how to grow your own practice or book a business as you will. So that's one thing. Another thing that we've tried to identify groups and mentors and have some structure and some check-ins where people will have someone who is going to reach out to them or and other people they have to reach out to try and stay in touch and just see, you know, see how people are doing. And then the other half of it is there are people who want to be in the office, but that's not as much fun. That's not rewarding. If you're by yourself and you're rattling around in these offices, the several floors, most of which are empty. So we've started to think about how do we, in order to make that, to have that experience for the people who want to be in the office, how do we make it enjoyable, fun, attractive to actually also get people back in the office voluntarily?
Yeah.
So that's a whole, you know, that's been a whole other effort and program to try to have events, gets togethers, lunches, coffees, and encouraging people actually to come back. So on the one hand, we've embracing work from anywhere and trying to make that useful and rewarding in its own way. But we recognize there are people who want to get back in the office, and how do we maximize that experience as well? And that's probably going to also include some redesign of office space and the common areas, because what sense does it make to for people to come back to the office to have a community experience and then just walk into the four corners of their own office? That makes no sense. The office should be for situations where people congregate and get together. And we have to think about designing office spaces in ways that promote that.
I know a lot of other firms seem to be more interested in kind of a return to normal or a return to a more pre-pandemic office experience. It sounds like your view is, let's take what we learned, let's acknowledge people like work in that way, let's try to figure out how to have a healthy balance. Do you envision these other firms will be successful getting people back in the office? Do you think they'll give up on that at some point? Or do you think that you might have to moderate your policies and try to say, okay, that, you know, look, let's get back together more frequently, get people back in the office? I mean, how do you view it more long term?
Yeah, I assume that can be done. I mean, if people really don't want to go back, if they've had a taste of working from anywhere and they want to continue to do that, maybe they'll change jobs. Maybe we'll get their resumes, which would be fine with us. And so our own approach is we want to be able to offer both ways and make it both an in-office experience for those who want that. And we want that to be as good as it can be, and a work from anywhere experience. And we want that to be as good as it can be. I personally think there's no turning back to a, you know, situation where everybody's expected to be in the office. Candidly, here in Los Angeles, where I am, even before the pandemic, you could come to our offices, and I would have guessed that, you know, maybe only 40% of the offices on any given day saw a human being in them.
Yeah.
In a way, it was really kind of a not the optimal use of a real estate space. I just don't think it's ever going to, at least for us, I don't think it's going to turn back to the way it was.
You're coming off what I have to imagine is in the running for your most successful year in firm history. I want to read some of these figures from the American Lawyer just because they're kind of eye-popping. They say that firm revenue rose 27% to around $1.6 billion. Profits per equity partner rose 23% to nearly 5.8 million. It was a great year for a lot of law firms. What accounted for your firm's huge growth last year?
Well, I mean, we really were hitting on all cylinders in all litigation practice areas, you know, from antitrust to certainly intellectual property. We have a very large patent litigation practice, and especially during the pandemic, technology, the whole sector, every aspect of it, including litigation, has been super hot. International arbitration, you know, we're in 11 countries, 30 offices now around the world. International arbitration was super busy. Financial services, we do a lot of work, you know, for all different kinds of funds, private equity funds, venture capital funds, hedge funds, structured finance type claims. It's all very busy. Government-facing regulatory work. Those teams who do white collar work and other types of government facing work were extremely busy. So I would say the firm was pretty busy across the board. I mean, we're a litigation or disputes only firm, But within that, there's a whole range of different types of litigation specialties. And the only one that was, you could say, wasn't super hot would perhaps is the bankruptcy and restructuring, because you know there was so much money around. A lot of companies that you know, otherwise maybe wouldn't stay afloat based on the results, they could get money and refinance. So that area, although folks have been busy there, it hasn't been super hot like it has been in other areas.
Is that continuing? I mean, there's a lot of concern now about the economy, people talking about whether we'll go see a recession soon. What have you seen through the first 6 months of the year?
I mean, it hasn't affected us. I mean, I read the same things that you do, that there has been a slowdown in the growth, but the economy is still growing. There's inflation, obviously, is an issue, and interest rates increasing are impacting some industries. But in terms of our practice and the kind of work we see, it hasn't slowed down at all. You know, a lot of people say that litigation is countercyclical, that in, you know, in not so good times, litigation does really, really well, and less well in good times. Honestly, I've never seen that. I think litigation, you know, good litigators are busy in both good times and bad times. You could say that actually in during good times, when companies are making a lot of money, they have the wherewithal to pursue discretionary claims, claims that they otherwise might not pursue. And of course, when there's a downturn, you have other practice, you know, deals don't work, deals fall apart, there can be disputes, and you have bankruptcy and restructuring related work. That, the latter obviously is cyclical. But I've never seen that litigation was cyclical, you know, that moved in tandem with a business cycle.
And you were saying, you know, obviously, a lot of Quinn's work is litigation, and it seems like a lot of what drove these other mega firms' success last year, past 2 years, was all this corporate work, doing deals for private equity firms. So, I mean, it is kind of fascinating to see a firm that's so litigation-focused have match all that.
No, look, there are firms, a lot of the firms that have large deal practices, especially private equity practices, capital markets practices, IPO practices, have done really, really well the last couple of years just because of the huge volume of deals. But actually, I mean, I also think that, you know, if the economy slows down, there's going to be some fallout from the deployment of so much money so fast, especially in the tech business, the venture capital business. And we'll see, we're going to see some, unfortunately, some deals, you know, that worked before won't work. And there will be work for firms like ours to do as a result of that.
So then it doesn't sound like you view last year's results for Quinn Emanuel as an anomaly in any way.
I mean, we did have a major contingent fee came in last year in a case that we had against the United States government relating to an aspect of Obamacare that was called risk corridors, where you know, the government had agreed to backstop insurance companies who assumed certain risks where there wasn't a history. And we brought that case, and it ended up going up to the United States Supreme Court. And overall, there was something like $7 billion that were recovered, and we got a significant fee out of that. It's going to be hard to beat that fee this year. So that aspect of last year was certainly different and unique.
You don't just manage a law firm; you continue to try cases, and you recently launched a podcast, and I've listened to it. You talk a lot about these interesting cases that Quinn Emanuel's working on. I think it's kind of like if you're a litigation junkie, you'd really, really like at least some of the episodes that I've listened to. The first being a case involving 3M earplugs. So I think it's a really good story. Also sort of a good example of how law firms can originate huge cases just from having people who are paying attention to what they're doing.
It's a great story. What is now the largest mass tort case, group of cases in the U.S. And it did start with an associate in our Los Angeles office who found a document. Now, the background to this is that 3M had sued our client, Moldex, for patent infringement on an earplug. And we didn't think it was a meritorious claim, and we got rid of that case and then brought a sham litigation antitrust claim against 3M, including a California unfair competition claim that they were using. This claim was brought in violation, you know, as unfair competition and in violation of the antitrust laws.
Up until this point, there's no mention of faultiness in the earplugs.
It starts out as a patent case.
Yeah.
And then it becomes a sham litigation / antitrust case that we brought. And in the course of that, 3M produced a bunch of documents. Our associate found in the documents a document which has now become known as the Flange Report. And it's an internal 3M document that acknowledges all kinds of problems and raises lots of issues concerning these 3M combat arms earplugs that were sold to the United States military to the tune of millions of items over the course of 15 years. And this internal document raises real questions about the functioning of these earplugs. At the next deposition of a 3M executive, we confronted him with this document. Executive said he'd never seen it before. It was alarming. He was going to talk to the lawyers about it. And within the next day or two, 3M took that earplug off the market. They were no longer distributing it. And we brought a QI-TAM action against 3M on behalf of the United States. And as the government can in those cases, the Department of Justice intervened, took over the case, settled the case, and then issued a press release and making that whole story about the defective earplugs public. And that caught the attention of the plaintiff's mass tort bar. And they started filing cases, and now there are over 300,000 cases that have been brought. And they are centralized in a multi-district litigation proceeding in Florida, Pensacola, Florida. So, I mean, it's kind of an amazing story that this document was found. And, the next thing you know, we have the largest mass tort litigation in history.
What happens with the associate? He gets a big bonus, or he's just an employee doing his job?
His name is Matt Hosen. You can work from anywhere at our firm. I think we discussed that.
Yeah.
And so Matt has moved to Pensacola, Florida, where he is now. And he's very interested in mass tort work and has gotten to know a lot of the leaders in that practice area as a result of this case. And he obviously is spending a lot of time still on the 3M earplugs mass tort litigation.
I don't know. That doesn't sound like the type of bonus I'd be expecting getting him.
He likes it.
That'll do it for today's episode of On the Merits. It was produced by myself, David Schultz. Our editor is Andrew Satter, and our executive producer is Josh Block. Reach out to us on Twitter if you have anything on your mind. We use the handle @BLaw. I'm @DavidBSchultz. That's B as in Hollywood Boulevard, which is where Quinn's Art Museum is located. Check it out if you're in the area. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
When it comes to the environment, there are, let's say, a lot of moving parts. Climate change, air pollution, chemical contamination, endangered species. It's a lot. That's where Parts Per Billion comes in. Join us on the Parts Per Billion podcast every other Wednesday to sort out everything that's going on in the environment, from the courts to Congress to your backyard. Download and subscribe to Bloomberg Law's Parts Per Billion wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening.